So we're going to begin with our final panel discussion, something we've all been waiting for, where all of those burning questions we didn't get to address to our satisfaction earlier throughout the week. Now is the time to double back on it. And so the basic ground rule here is anyone can ask any question, and including those on the panel, if they'd like to pose a question to their colleagues to elaborate on anything that has come out of the presentations, or the Supreme Court visit, or our Royals talk. Anything really is fair game. So with that, we'll take it away with our closing panel.
Nice.
Well, Adrian was thinking that maybe you want to announce an initial, maybe you want to ask a first question?
I guess one thing we thought was that there seemed to be substantial interest in the room the past couple days on religious liberty issues, and that would sort of tie into our conversation with Justice Alito, which was heavily on that topic. So we thought we'd, you know, open it up to questions, but especially questions.
Maybe the first question
on
that, yeah. And then go from there. So it doesn't need to focus on that beyond. Yeah, Desmond, you want?
I feel that would be very substantive. I have like a minor question before we jump into that. So a question I've had about St. Thomas Aquinas, I think this is mainly directed to you, Father Legge, but anyone can take it up. I've understood the general intuition of, I think we have, where it doesn't make sense to legislate in a positive way all virtue, or to kind of legislate away or kind of categorize as a crime everything that's a vice, you know, even if it's a serious vice. And one of the examples that St. Thomas gives, if I remember correctly, is prostitution, that we shouldn't.
Yeah.
Outlaw prostitution. Can you run me through the logic of why not? Because my general sense is that would be a great thing to outlaw. I mean,
I don't think he has especially. I think his argument is very. He doesn't give a lot of detail. It's very simple. It's just that sometimes trying to stamp out a vice will cause more disorder than just tolerating it in some measure. So, you know, in Fribourg, where I live now, it's an old Catholic city in Switzerland. It's officially, you know, the canton is officially confessionally Catholic. There's no separation of church and state. So, I mean, to talk about religious liberty, I mean, I have lived in a confessional state and seen how that works. And it's very, the contrasts are very interesting. So the public schools are Catholic schools. There's a crucifix in every classroom. The public hospital is a Catholic hospital. There's a chapel with the Blessed Sacrament. The tax money is collected on behalf of the church and distributed to the church, which means the church is very wealthy in a certain sense. So you have very high salaries for church employees, you know. So like the music director at the local parish is making six figures and is like has a whole bunch of employees under him or her, you know. So like there's no shortage of employment in the church. But it's had all kinds of very negative consequences, too. Okay, well, I didn't want to go there. I'm talking already about religious liberty questions. Prostitution. So it's an old Catholic city since the Middle Ages. There's a monastery right at the base of the hill that was there before the city existed, and down by the river. And the street that leads down to the river is the street of the brothels. That's been there since the Middle Ages. And I learned after a week of living there that that's the street that, as a Dominican out for a walk in the afternoon in my habit, is the street I shouldn't walk down. Because we walk down and everybody's looking at you like, why are you here, Father? You're not supposed to come to this street. So it's just like, it's regulated. The prostitutes have to register with the police. They're not allowed to solicit prostitution on the street openly. So they try to have, I mean, I don't think that's a good idea at all, of course. But they regard it as like better than what would happen if it was, I mean, it's like the debate over drug legalization and stuff like that. It's a kind of prudential judgment about how bad is this really and how easy is it to stamp out. And
but what would happen? What is this kind of elusive other scenario where prostitution is illegal? And
I'm not defending it. I'm not defending it. I think it is bad, and I would, if I were in charge, I would outlaw it. You know, I think you can do that.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, so I guess in a way the question would be, what are the goods that are at stake that we're trying to balance and maintain? Just looking at it, right, one would think one good is the good of freedom, right? Freedom of people from certain kinds of laws, right? Laws that might be overly rigorous, imprudent with regard to expectation of people to follow them or something like that. And I'm kind of asking, like, what if anything do you see Thomas trying to balance here, right? Then some sort of good of public order, right? You referred to public order, right? And so, I mean, I guess in a sense, like, the idea would be something like, you don't want to pass laws, right, that you expect people will disregard routinely, right? Because that will somehow have a corrosive effect, not just on that law itself, but possibly on laws more generally, right? And there may be some other, goods that are involved too, the good of just, for instance, cultivating virtue among people or trying through the law to teach people that there are certain kinds of right and wrong behaviors, right? And some are so grave enough that even despite possible threats to public order, given their gravity, right, you're going to still nonetheless express those as law. Do you see, like, goods like those operating here?
Yeah, I think also he thinks, judgment? I mean, my guess is that, this is somebody who's saying, well, try to show me a civilization that hasn't had prostitution, whether it's legal or illegal, so maybe we'd be better off just saying we're not going to be able to stamp that. I mean, it's a sin, and it's... Now, I think a better example is the one that I used about, like, lying to your mother. Because for us, it doesn't... I think it's a little clearer, like, what kind of disorders would result from that, if you tried to bring public law into that kind of setting.
Yeah,
I think it's really just a prudential question, I think. When you get into the particulars.
Are these hands on this question? Dominic, did you have something?
I just have a brief comment on this. If I remember correctly, I don't think that Thomas actually recommends this as a policy. He's actually just citing Augustine as an authority, and Augustine, who does...
Always blaming Augustine.
But my understanding is that it has to do with Augustine, right, and the concupiscence, and that actually men wouldn't be able to control themselves. So you have an outbreak of sexual assault if there wasn't this social outlet in brothels. So that's I think if you're asking, like, how could this possibly justify, I think that's actually where Augustine goes with it. But I do think today, it's hard. I mean, it's hard to kind of sympathize with that line of thought.
Well, I know one of the arguments for the legalization of prostitution today is that, and I'm not necessarily defending the argument, but that if prostitution is legalized, it will give police a better handle on being able to deal with slavery issues. Because right now, police, it's difficult to distinguish between prostitutes who are doing it voluntarily and prostitutes who are doing it involuntarily.
So, I mean, all of these things go to Father's point, then, that there's a kind of prudential element in trying to figure out whether or not, right, to permit this activity.
Yeah.
I think related to your point, though, too, is, like, this sense about, like, the place of concubines in a society, right? And in classical societies, you had certain kinds of roles for, right, women who served that irrepressible urge that men appeared to have, right? And as those are no longer countenanced, there's, right, the idea is there's some other outlet for this, because it doesn't just, of course, harm the man, right? It harms family, right? Marriages and so on, right? And, like, sort of systems of legitimate outlet that allow men to, fulfill, again, this irresistible urge or something can lead to a kind of ordering that even preserves families. But these seem like odd arguments.
Yeah, I don't buy that argument myself. But could,
right,
I propose that we move to religious liberty, which I think is...
But there are a couple of people I think who want to finish it off with just a couple...
I want to connect this line to that bigger question.
Okay, good, yeah.
The question about permitting vice for the sake of public order is, in fact, exactly the argument that Leo XIII makes in Immortale Dei and Libertas, right? That here's the ordering of Christian society that would be ideal for,
these things to take place. There's no absolute right for speech. There's no particular absolute right for religious freedom. However, right, there are prudential cases in which it makes sense for the sake of public order to allow something that's less than the ideal. So my question, I guess, is there a development from that position to what we see in Dignitatis Humanae, or is Dignitatis Humanae just executing within the bounds of that prudential, executing a prudential judgment about the state of the modern world and saying, listen, you know, the Christian society ought to be ordered in this way. That's not feasibly available to us with the hope of maintaining public order. So here's the argument. So it's about the status of the conciliar statement on religious freedom. Does it simply fall within the realm of prudential judgment, do you think, or would you say that there's a development on the substance of the issue itself?
I think that's a debatable question, and it would require us to go back and look carefully at Dignitatis Humanae. And I mean, I know some Dominicans among them, Father Dominic Verner, who have done some work on this question precisely, like the interpretation of Dignitatis Humanae and what is it really saying. So it is a little hard to say, in part because the Second Vatican Council had a lot of, I mean, this was a major issue of debate. They're not addressing a particular situation or a particular crisis. They're addressing kind of a general setting. That is, the church in the modern world and the developments in the 20th century that have provoked a need to kind of rearticulate Catholic, the Catholic doctrine on this. And because they're not addressing a particular situation, the stakes are in a sense lower, so they don't actually have to make a judgment about any particular thing, which meant you had people in the room with a lot of, you know, this side is not necessarily intending to say the same thing as this side, and they had to come up with compromise language that they just made somewhat elastic and a little bit, I think, ambiguous at certain points, so that it could be read in one way or it could be read in another way, and everybody could sort of sign off on it. Because these were consensus documents. I mean, most of the documents of the Second Vatican Council were passed by a near unanimity. So when you have 1,000 bishops unanimously signing a document that is actually on a controverted question, it suggests that maybe, like, they're just restating what the minimal things that everybody can agree, or at least that's what they understand themselves to be doing. And I think that's kind of what's happening. So you can make an argument for like a strong development of doctrine there, and you can also make an argument that, well, this is actually just kind of atmospheric like gestures without really intending to change what was said before. Maybe Father White wants to chime in here because he's has opinions about this.
I think that the Vatican Council documents in many cases are entirely malleable hermeneutically, in the sense that you can make potentially very diverse arguments and still remain faithful to the text, insofar as the text can be interpreted in different ways. I do think there were attempts to say at the time that the document was merely pragmatic or prudential and didn't elaborate principles, and there was pretty strong pushback against that from the Holy See and saying, no, there are elaborations of principles. But, I mean, the problem is the first line is like, this changes nothing that's gone before. My own views are actually, in a way, to the right and to the left of Thomas Paine's, because he argues that there's not really been a change from Leo XIII. And I actually have an even more, I think, perhaps provocative and maybe misplaced thesis, which is that there's been no development of doctrine on the Church's teaching on religious liberty, and that the principles of Dignitatis Humanae are identical with what you find in Thomas Aquinas. It's just that there's multiple principles at work when you talk about the respect of dissenters or of heretics and that kind of thing. And you can apply them differently, prudentially, in different circumstances, but I don't think there's been a mutation of principles. So my sense is that Dignitatis Humanae can be read in pretty strong continuity with everything that came before, and it's using the same principles in a slightly different prudential fairly different prudential way in a very different historical context. And so actually the intellectual continuity is vibrant. And I think you can show this by looking at, I mean, to be boiled down to a very brief statement, it seems to me the church always insists on the specificity of the truth, the obligation of responsibility to seek the truth, to adhere to it once one finds it, and the right of the state to defend and promote the truth, and we lose the real truth. And the state insists on the, you might say, objective importance of human subjectivity and the free consent of the truth, and therefore wants to delimit, but can permit, in limited, prudentially applicable ways, the coercion of people who don't consent to the truth. Right, so you want to take people's subjectivity seriously when they're in error, because there's a dignity to their human freedom and self-reflection. That's absolutely present in their lives. It's absolutely present in the tradition. And this freedom of conscience stuff that you find in the Puritans or in the Protestant centers, you find all those principles already in the Catholics. So I just think the church has maybe leaned on some principles more in one age and more on some principles in other ages, but I don't actually think the principles have changed. That's a very rare view, but I would like to defend it as I continue to think about write about this.
I mean, the other thing I'd add is I think the what we have, what I mentioned a couple times about the common good being limited from above as well as from below. If you say it's just from below, what are we talking about? Like the right of the subject with respect to determining, you know, judgments of conscience. That seems like a constraint from the dignity just of the individual citizens. But speaking about it from above, what are we talking about? That the political order does not have care of the of a religious common good or of a transcendent good that exceeds the common good of the community. So its care is for our political life together, which is a terrestrial life. Now, religious goods are part of that. It's not to say that a well-ordered like polity shouldn't be worried about the religious practices of its citizens. It should be. But it doesn't have jurisdiction, in a way, over those religious practices in the same way that it has jurisdiction over all the other ways that we relate to each other. Because there, in fact, what you're trying to regulate is a citizen's relationship with a much higher authority. So, like, you better be careful about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with this. I think it's actually less rare than you think, Thomas, Father Thomas. That
it must be a circle.
Well, I think that's Dulles' position, right? I think Cardinal Dulles' position was more or less the same, that there's, right, that the principles that are articulated there are the principles that you can find throughout the tradition. What was that? Oh, good. Well, the argument is a very precise argument. It's about civil society, right? And it's about within civil society there is a freedom, or, you know, of immunity from coercion with regard to belief, but it's rooted in the obligation of the individual and of the political community to God, right? It's rooted, it's not just a kind of, as my student puts it, it's not a protection of sincere conscience. It's a protection of conscience that's ordered towards truth, right? And that's an obligation that not only the individual has to fulfill, right, but also individuals as members of communities, religious communities and other kinds of communities, and also religious communities as part of a polis, right? Even the political community has an obligation not merely not to, like, sort of put hindrances into belief, but to cultivate among their citizens openness to the truth, the capacity to fulfill that, I think, natural obligation. Dulles and others, I think, you know, would argue that it, right, there's not really some sort of rupture here, there's not really some sort of significant development, that the principles that that both of you articulated are principles that you can find in the tradition. Obviously, points of emphases are different, you know, in the ways that we've discussed this week, given different sociological realities and so on. But there's a kind of, there's an old thing there that we're seeing. And the document also says, right, there's a kind of growing sense of, you know, consciousness of the, you know, human dignity and a person's, you know, self-understanding and so on, which is probably true, right? And that therefore requires a kind of emphatic instantiation of this freedom from immunity, freedom of immunity in a community, in civil societies. That's a good, and maybe that might have been something that wasn't quite emphasized the same way before.
Yeah, I mean, I think where we are in the conversation is wondering if we need more, not just authority, but a coercive power within the church and outside, in civil society. And, of course, that makes everybody's modern liberal individual sensibilities and so on alert. But there is that's also in the tradition. And, of course, it is part of the fabric of the church and civil society and the contemporary code of canon law, as Thomas Pink points out rightly. And the question is, like, how do you balance those two things?
Which are the two things you're balancing? I'm sorry.
Coercive. Like the Catholic priest who starts preaching that everything the church teaches is false, which happens occasionally. And then, like, you're not going to be allowed to preach anymore, and we're going to actually dismiss you from the priesthood, and you're going to lose your health care. He's not being, punished corporeally as he might have been in another century. Or whatever, but he is being punished corporally for losing his health care. We always say somebody else is going to pay for health care. He can't be a ward of the church.
But I think Dignitatis Humanae says this is about civil society, right? And civil society cannot coerce, which leaves open the possibility that ecclesial authority, going to the jurisdictional stuff, can.
Well, it does.
Right. So yeah. So I.
It does even today.
Right, but how's that different?
That's the point.
Right.
I think Father Thomas Joseph's point is that there is a. We would have to recognize that there. It's a question of prudential judgment about when and to what degree. But the idea that there could be some penalty if you are a member of a religious community and you begin to disrupt the religious community.
Sure.
That the principle that you could be in some way disciplined by the religious community, or then another question would be, what if you have a confessional state where the religious community is saying to the prince, hey, this guy is a problem, kick him out of the city.
Right. Well, this is, let me just try to hear Father Thomas Joseph on this, if I may. Because as I understand the Pink view, it goes beyond ecclesiastical discipline on priests and members of religious orders. The Pink view is that even after Dignitatis Humanae, in a confessional state, it would be still open to the church to delegate to the secular arm coercive authority over all the baptized to prevent...
Well, here again, I'm kind of more to his right than to his left. So I think that the coercive power could, to some in different ways, apply also to the non-baptized. So if you have, for example, a non-Christian religion that is regularly practicing religiously motivated terrorism, the state could protect people according to the norms of natural law by using coercive power against those cells, as it were, or that movement, those movements that are religiously motivated. And we wouldn't say, in the name of Dignitatis Humanae, you have to let them perform terrorist actions. And lo and behold, I think liberal secularists do this all the time, based also on theological criteria. And that if we got into the inner workings of the Department of Defense and the CIA, we would find that they are trying to advocate and pay for the spread of modern Islam to the tune of tens of millions of dollars a year, whilst, in scripted ways, using cruise missiles to kill people whose theological views they disagree with. So I'm not even sure in the post-Christian secular state this kind of coercive behavior is avoided. In fact, I think it's gotten intensified, and there's great intelligence study conducted to try to be ruthlessly efficient at it. And we find it in Israeli states, we find it in Saudi Arabian states. So, I think you find it in India, you find it in China, and there's lots of differences about the justice or injustice in which it's conducted. I think with Chinese are doing to the Uyghur population is gravely unjust. But the point is that you have, civic controls over religiously marginal elements that become socially disruptive is just part and parcel of the fabric of human community. And the church would have to have normally a higher standard of mandate for that that would be informed by a strong and rigorous knowledge of natural law, justice according to natural law, and ecclesiastical justice with regards to the baptized. Which can still involve tolerance. You don't have to kill Huguenots. It's not obviously that helped France remain to this day a great religious civilization because they wiped out all the Huguenots. Look at them today. It's not paradise. So I think the use of the coercion is always vindicated by history. But I think it's on the table. In fact, I don't mean it's like theoretically on the table. We're actually doing it. What we're not doing is reflecting on its usage sufficiently.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, does anybody want to respond to that before I
No, you should respond to it.
Well, I think there's good reasons to respond to it, but there may be other people who want. Do you want to respond to that, Paul?
Just a quick distinction. Could we distinguish between those other religious elements that are causing violent disorder versus other religious elements that are causing nonviolent disorder? Is that a distinction that any governing civic body would use or not?
Well, I just don't. Oh, well, I mean, obviously that's a real distinction, okay? And that distinction matters a great deal to our history. But you notice that when we asked even a great intellectual person like Sam Alito about this question yesterday of how you distinguish, he doesn't really have there's not a strong working civic idea of what's the distinction between a bad religion and a good religion. It's just freedom of religion. And then when they start, you start having sort of religiously motivated warlike activity. Okay, well that, but not because there's a religious problem, except that we're also going to try to support religiously motivated peaceful coexistence by funding modern Islam. So I think it's unselfconscious. It's unreflective inquisition. It's liberal, unreflective inquisition. And then they go after the Catholics on the things that don't accord with, like, secular liberal doctrines. But, my point is I think everyone has sort of theological or anti-theological presuppositions, and they're often unreflective. And so we actually, part of the survey we need to do is actually think about what are the motivations and the natural law viewpoints of people who have very different viewpoints, but who are actually motivated to coerce religionists of a different kind. I don't think there's equivalency. I think there's radical differentiation, but a lot of people don't. A lot of secular people don't think there's any differentiation, really.
Amy and Luke, you guys, I just want to
weigh in. I was just going to, I mean, I think it's a really good explanation of how the state cannot be neutral towards religion, right? The state's always going to be taking a position. But I understood, like, the conflict here as much more, like, specific to the church's jurisdiction over the baptized, and specifically over, like, their religious freedom or their religious participation. And, I mean, I think the more contentious issue, I mean, obviously, I think most people would agree that, like, as soon as somebody's disrupting civil society or peace, like, it's quite clear that the civil authority can step in. But where it's more contentious is whether the church can use the secular branch for the purposes of enforcing its jurisdiction over the baptized. And that's the contentious point, rather than, I mean, of course, the state's not going to be neutral towards religion, it's going to enforce what it wants to do. And that's going to involve, you know, moderate Islam combined with secular liberalism. But, you know, the question is, if you had a state that was more friendly to Catholicism, that was willing to work with the church, you know, has the policy of the church changed in terms of the availability of what remedies it can seek in terms of, you know, bringing heretics back into the fold?
Yeah.
I mean, I think, and to focus the question a little bit, maybe we could distinguish between looking at a religious community or somebody who's preaching in the city and saying, well, this is a threat to the public, to public order.
Right.
And that's my job, like I'm the civil magistrate, that's my job, like to make sure that we don't have violence and this is starting to produce violence, so I need to work on that.
Right.
Versus the church saying, this is causing confusion about a supernatural doctrine of the faith.
Right.
And, but no discernible immediately cognizable thing for the political community. But by the way, civil magistrate, I want you to go like actually evict that guy from the city. Involved in that? It seems to me that you can distinguish those things. Although you might, in Father White's defense, you might be able to say, well, actually, that second case is always going to produce like the. Those disagreements among co-religionists is already going to have civil effects. Like, you can't just disentangle those things.
Right.
Prudentially, you often see it when property is taken. So when Lefebvre's in France come into churches in Paris and take them from the Catholic Church, occupy them, which has happened recently, or when Anglican groups break off from the Episcopalian Church and take the property in the United States, or when in St. Louis you had the liberal Catholics who broke off when Archbishop Burke was there and took the church, then you have canonical procedures internal to these bodies, and there are obviously different theologies involved. And then you have civic suits to get the property back. And the state is being put at the service of the church's theological polity based on its own canon law. And if you prove that they're a breakaway sectarian movement who are disrupting the unity and the material wealth of the church, you get your church back. You know, so that's just, I'm just saying that happens now. The question is, could that be more aggressive? I don't see why not. I mean, I'm not saying I would not necessarily advocate for it, but I don't think the principles have changed. I think it's just the prudential application.
I want to go over to Roger, who had a question, like to take us back to our conversation with Justice Alito. You had an initial question about religious liberty.
Well, actually, my question was pretty much what has been discussed. I wanted to basically re-ask the same question I raised the other day about the compatibility between the traditional teaching of the church, expressed by Synod Asking of the church, as the coercive powers over the baptized, and now all of a sudden we believe in religious liberty.
There are probably one third of our participants who've not intervened at any length or asked questions. Is there a religious liberty question, religious liberty related question from someone in that category, Edward?
So I'm going to try to formulate this question out loud. Random thought. So as I understand, in the Summa, Thomas does define religion in a particular way, and it's defined, if I remember correctly, around cult and ritual. And it seems that in contemporary religious liberty debates, the most contentious ones are dealing with things that aren't necessarily traditionally understood as cult or ritual. So creating floral arrangements as part of one's personal vocation in worshiping God in that way. So I'm just wondering, in a Thomistic natural law framework, how do we understand those sorts of conscientious activity of pursuing these different goods of human fulfillment, if you will? How do we understand that as actually religious activity when we see that there are definitions out there of religion as cult, ritual, etc.? Now, I understand that the sort of liberal justices, say Ginsburg in her dissent in Hobby Lobby, is saying basically she wants to keep religious liberty protections for churches because they are centered around a religious purpose and people voluntarily choose to associate with each other around those particular religious purposes. So if that's the sort of given understanding of what religion is, but then a natural law understanding has this concept that all these different activities can be taken up, subsumed into a religious life, a religious action. How do we sort of create reasonable boundaries? How do we understand and distinguish what is religious activity, what is not religious activity, and keep that sort of in line with what Thomas might have to say about what religion is, what conscience is?
Adrian, do you want
to? There's a lot of references to law and justices.
I don't know what to say. So Thomas had no occasion, I think, to address the sorts of problems at issue in these cases, because the problems arise only because there is a state that is trying to enforce in the marketplace a very particular conception of justice. One that simply wasn't present in Thomas's political space. So I don't know that we ought to say that in these circumstances Thomas would have limited his definition of religion to the sorts of things he was addressing in his own time. So no particular reason to think that. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Certainly. I guess I'm just trying to understand how we sort of take the work within a Thomistic framework, you know, working from his text to applying that to our own situation today. Because it seems that if we start understanding so many activities that the world would understand as secular, and saying that that's religious, it starts to get very complicated in terms of. It seems to the world that we're just asking for exemptions all the time, and that, in my mind, that doesn't really help the religious conservatives' sort of case, because it just seems like we're always asking and grasping, right, and being unreasonable in things. So I'm just trying to understand how we can articulate what we're trying to pretend in a way that is faithful to our tradition, but then also might make sense to others.
Yeah, I don't think I would accept your distinction between, like, I think Aquinas thinks that a religious duty or the virtue of religion can touch, is actually very broad in its scope. In other words, it is an orientation towards God as your creator and the principle, you know, the principle of your life and the end of your life, which means that it isn't just about what you do for 1 hour a week, you know, on Sunday. It's actually much, much more profound reverence. Father White,
Eddie, I have to disagree with you on the premise. I think you're getting Aquinas wrong there. Where does he put religion? It's a virtue of justice, and what formally characterizes it is what we call convotio, by which he means not sort of modern emotions, but the orientation of the heart to serve God in all things, coextensive with all human behavior and activity. He defines and treats sanctity, interestingly, not as charity, but according to this natural virtue of consecrating everything in your life to one end, which is God. So that means it's architectonic, and it assimilates the way you behave in court to all your other, you know, obligations, virtues, professional life, etc. So there's a kind of omnicomprehensivity to religion, religio, for Aquinas. And that helps you think about, when you have a very religious person who may disagree with you, like you look at a very devout Muslim, and they're saying, look, I want to consecrate all my life to Quranic principles. There's a kind of holism to it. So when they feel burdened by something that dissuades them, or they feel grates against the unity of their life, you don't have to agree with them about the truth, but you can say, look, that's part of their religiosity, the totality and holism of their life. And I think that's intelligible.
Yeah, can I try to redeem Eddie's question as I understand it, right? So it seemed to me like the real thrust of it was the last stuff you said about, it seems like we're kind of grasping, right, as religious people, right, today. And we're fighting for carving out space in terms of freedom of conscience typically, right? And those kinds of spaces, those kinds of battles that we're having as religious communities have to sort of proceed on a certain conception of conscience or religiosity or faith or whatever you want to describe it, right, that is hobbled from perhaps the perspective of Thomas or the perspective of the tradition itself, right? And let me give an example perhaps that might make some sense of this, and I'm going to say things about the law that'll get me in trouble or, you know, that you can please correct. So if you look at, like, the conscientious objection stuff, right, that and how in the United States and how that legal doctrine has developed over time, it starts out very precise, defined around conceptions of religious communities, those members, right? The expectation is, you know, members of the Amish, Jehovah's Witnesses, people who are members of identifiable religious communities, because they're members of those communities, they're nonviolent, right? This is the way they're formed. We are going to carve out an exception for them in the law where they don't have to serve, right? Over time, what happens, right, is that detaches, right, that the possibility of exception from the law detaches from identifiable membership in religious communities, even perhaps certain conceptions of religious beliefs, to something much broader, and something like, I use the phrase already, sincere conscience, right? I have a sincere conscience that's pacifist or nonviolent. Are you a member of a religious community? No. Right, do you have, you know, conceptions of, you know, God, etc. No, not really. I just write, you know, I just believe it's wrong, sincerely, it's deeply held. That becomes protected, right, more or less, over time in the law. And now we, trying to carve out exceptions for beliefs that stem from a kind of more fulsome conception of religious faith, have to argue in ways that look more like that and less like, hey, we're Catholic. This is what Catholics do. These are our practices. You know, this stuff about, for instance, contraception, it's not primarily a conscience claim so much as it is a claim about the truth of things, right? The way beings are dignified, they express their dignity in sexual relationships, you know, the good of children and, you know, families and so on, right? We'll make the conscience claim argument, right, if that's what's necessary to carve out the space. But to do so, you know, you have this kind of intuition, right? That's a kind of rear guard battle, right? That's not, right? That's a, we've already conceded, you know, half the field, right, to the opposition, and we're just trying to dig in before we're kind of shoved off the cliff here, right? Is that kind of what you're getting at, or am I way afield?
No. I think so. Well, just to respond real quick to Father Thomas Joseph, extremely useful thinking about religion within the paradigm of justice, and for me, extremely helpful. So thank you for that. I guess what I'm trying to get at, in part, is if we understand religion as taking up basically everything that constitutes our lives, our actions, etc. I'm just wondering in the context of organizations, for example. And you have churches that are clearly, you know, as we understand in our conception of religion, these are clearly religious organizations that have a religious purpose. And then you have your institutions like Masterpiece Cake Shop that may be operating on religious commitments as well, right? In terms of now applying the human positive law onto the protection of these religious activities, Are these sorts of legal regimes, these sorts of rights, should they be the same types of protections based off of the goods that they're trying to protect, the ends that they're trying to protect? Because they're both now religious. So I'm just trying to understand, how do we distinguish a legal regime protecting Masterpiece Cake Shop from a legal regime that's protecting the Catholic Church down the street?
There's some answer.
Can I just jump in with a macro reaction to this? And sort of going back more to your first question, Eddie, the end part of your first question about always playing defense, I don't think there are ever going to be great answers to your second sort of question in this framework for the following reason. I think we're playing a kind of structurally losing game. So let me explain. I think at the time of the Second Vatican Council, there was a sense that it was the heyday of Christian democracy in Europe, heyday of this kind of giant rallying to democracy on the part of Catholicism after World War II. And there was this sense that you could reach a permanent, long-term, stable rapprochement between Catholicism and liberal democracy. They could be cooperative partners, and that you could baptize the liberal order from within. And people, you know, European theorists actually spoke of it, you know, another Rome baptized from within by Catholicism. I think it's become increasingly clear in the ensuing 60 years, whatever, that project is unraveling in a long-term structural way. And I think the mistake was to think that Catholicism was ever dealing with a secular polity. I think it was never dealing with a secular polity. I think it was dealing with a polity that has become increasingly dominated by a very particular world religion called the religion of humanity, that has its own views and wants ultimately to enforce those views on the society. And that what you see in these religious freedom cases is an endless, as Joe said, rearguard action, trying to carve out spaces within which, you know, Catholicism can flourish, but always ceding ground because the basic premises of the order in which we live are in some sense antithetical to Catholicism. So if we're in this kind of structurally losing game, then look, defense is important. You can't win without defense. But what you should be thinking about, and I think the thing we all need to be thinking about, is ultimately you have to get back on offense. And ultimately, if you're in a structurally losing game, no clever move, no clever strategy is going to save you. What you have to do is change the game. So that's sort of my orientation towards these questions, if that makes any sense.
So it seems like Kyle and Joseph are both very insistently wanting to intervene.
And Luke as well.
And, okay, Luke too, yeah.
Well, I think actually most of what I was going to say has already been said, so I'm going to keep this brief. I do think that in the way we're describing religion, we're working towards kind of a very dangerous, difficult, very, very, very broad definition that when you get into the public sphere and start dealing with other religions and pseudo-religions and philosophies, becomes very difficult to actually maintain. And so I think it's useful to make a distinction between what is very firmly and clearly religious activity, as we were describing at the beginning, and our sacred activity, our life activity that is based on those religious principles that we want to say is sacred, is directed towards God, but that is not specifically religious activity that is within the ritual structure of the church. I think there might be an important distinction to make there, especially for practical purposes of discussing religion in a broader context. The other point to your last part of your question is I think we're in a context right now where there is a prudential measure where we do need to start strategically at points saying we need to be willing to suffer for the sake of Christ, to suffer for the sake of righteousness, instead of always fighting every battle to the end, because at some point that just starts alienating ourselves even more and causing problems. And I think there's, and I don't know where the line to draw there is. I don't know exactly how to draw that line, but I think if you especially look at the media, look at the broader culture, there is this sense of alienation of, it's those dumb Christians again, what's wrong with them, that we maybe want to be a little bit more careful with.
Yeah, so just to jump in on this, but also the previous discussion on the deeply toxic sort of previous approach, I'm sympathetic to Avery Dulles' argument and the continuity. But there is actually an alternative interpretation that I wanted to toss out, and I wanted to hear more learned perspectives on it. And it's the perspective that's been tabled recently by Bishop Athanasius Schneider, that apart from Lumen Gentium and Sacrum Sanctum and Concilium, the other documents of Vatican II are largely pastoral in nature. And as with many other previous ecumenical councils, they are temporary, and they exist within a particular historical context. In fact, they may be irrelevant today, despite being relevant 50, 60 years ago. So that's the other perspective, which is less of a continuity, more of a, this was a product of its time, perhaps now we need a new approach, or a return to an old approach, when addressing these questions. I'd like to hear everyone's thoughts on that, and whether perhaps that also plays into the strategic concerns of how to move forward.
Well, I think it's certainly true that there was a particular context for the Second Vatican Council, and that it's not obvious that the problems that they were addressing are our problems. And I think, what Adrian just said about I do think that was the optimism of the 1960s among, Catholic, especially European Catholic, bishops probably. You also have to remember the context being after World War II and in view of the growth of totalitarian communism, like atheist communism. And the council is also, resisting that. So that, I think, is often also forgotten by us, that there was a very strong anti-communist dimension to this embrace, because they saw what was the threat? The threat was not liberal democracy. The threat was the totalitarian state that is claiming to have a kind of complete control over religion. And of course, we don't want that. Now we don't feel that threat in the same way. And so the threat of the secular, you know, the sort of interior threat in Western democracy is more evident to us. But we also, you know, when people talk about returning to a kind of integralism, what we don't want to do is go back to like the Caesaropapism that you had in the Byzantine Empire, where the secular authority is now, because it is allied so closely with the religious authority, exerting a lot of control over the religious authority. And that's very unhealthy. Even in Europe, it was a long struggle for the Catholic Church to gain the independence from secular authority to name bishops. And that's something we've also part of the history that we don't often think about. Like, we assume today that it's the Pope's role to name bishops. That is actually not historically been the majority. Like, for the majority of time, the Pope has not had the liberty to name bishops. The Pope was very constrained. So, often by concordat or customary, you know, customary practice, where it's actually the secular sovereign who was selecting a bishop, and the Pope who's kind of approving it, acting kind of like the U.S. Senate would vis-a-vis the president. Mm-hmm. And so that's a very limited power then to govern the church. So the papacy like fought for a long time to be free of that. So that's like the other side of trying to give too much to the state. And it's something that we should also be wary of. So like if George Weigel were here, he would be saying, hey, listen, that's an achievement of the 20th century that we finally got out from under that. And the church has been much stronger because of it. Like, the church is stronger today than it was then.
Right. I mean, yes, but the eschatological foe is no longer communism, right? And now perhaps it's prudent to sort of move the discourse beyond that and start sort of, again, restructuring the role of the church, the role today. I mean, the other point that we brought up with the discussion yesterday with Father Thomas Joseph was that perhaps geography should play a role as well, and perhaps in different parts of the world there should be different solutions proposed. I mean, we can't table the same proposal in America as in Europe, because in America was born of apostasy and the original sin of liberalism. And whereas in Europe, there's actually room for growth and return to alternative traditions. But we also can't posit the same quasi-integralist solutions for the third world, where the suffering church is actually still struggling with authoritarianism. So perhaps there actually should be more of a sort of subsidiarity approach, where there's devolution to the local councils and bishops to actually decide what the best approach is.
Yeah, I think Dignitatis Humanae is more or less making that kind of argument, right? That, I mean, you know, again, you'd have to identify the principles that are being advanced, beginning, as Father Thomas said, in his earliest comment, with the fact that it says explicitly, we are not developing doctrine. Right, it says, you know, on this, the traditional doctrine is right remains the same. Right, so it's about civil society and the space it carves out. It's about the libertas ecclesia, which you just spoke about, right? The freedom of the church itself, right? I mean, these are all elements of this. I think the classical approach of the church to these questions that now you have to sort of sift through try to figure out how do we live here and now where we are, right? To the specific question, just real quick. My only concern about Bishop Snyder's type approach or the approach that says, well, it's just pastoral, is that, is the just pastoral component of it, right? I mean, that's, right? I mean, that always seems to mean something that I hope we don't think it actually means, right? It's merely pastoral, therefore, you know, it could be completely mistaken. It's simply contingent, right? You can try to drive a wedge between the pastoral and, let's say, the dogmatic or something else that I hope we would be resistant to, you know, to do, right? I'd have to look more closely beyond that.
So, Father White, you want to just jump in briefly on this, and then we'll go to Luke.
I mean, you know, just to respond, like, I'm largely sympathetic to the idea that the Second Vatican Council is so
is written in such a different context and we have such a different context today that we do really need to think about other solutions, okay? But strategically, I disagree radically with the claim that it isn't thoroughly doctrinal. I mean, I think David Irving is thoroughly doctrinal and super important today when we're trying to get away from constraints or where the definitions and determinations of revelation, which that doctrine is very strong on. But on a sort of more tactical point, to claim that you're going to win this argument by ignoring or relativizing a major conciliar dimension of the church's history is fatalistically flawed. I mean, you have to go back and integrate it into a larger story,
right,
which doesn't mean thinking it's some ultimate statement of faith you can say. It's rather relativized to that, which I think almost everyone agrees on now, actually. But you need to integrate it in as a moment in the reflection of the historical development of doctrine, or the way we've determined. So I think you have to go back and actually win the argument about Vatican II. But one of the strong ways to do that is to say, unless we read it in such and such a way, its principles will now be irrelevant. We have to read it in a very different context with other considerations, and then you actually win the council to your side in light of the subsequent reading. And I think Newman is very helpful here. I think if you say, to respond to the council, we have to really act against it. You're never going to win that more internal intellectual debate in the church.
Well, if I could say just, I mean, I don't want to go down too far down this road, but, you know, we're Generation X people, right? We've spent our lives...
Some of you are.
Yeah, well, you're basically, I mean, we're the same age. We spent our lives, like, dealing with the baby boomers, you know? And that's still what we're dealing... Like, they just want to say incessantly, oh, all of your concerns were, like, you can't even have concerns because they were already decided by the great shining moment of the baby boomers.
Right.
And so, you know, don't even, it's already, there's no even conversation to have here. And so then the whole, like, our whole life has been, like, come on, there's more things to talk about. And it's not just all over. What's interesting is that with Pope Francis now, the debates that we're having don't have any reference to Vatican II. Like, Vatican II is just not even really part of the contemporary debate. And so what now, actually, our perspective is to say there is a very big Catholic tradition. It's not just Vatican II. Vatican II is a moment in a much bigger story. And the kind of questions that we're now being confronted with require us to understand the whole picture. Because this little slice, it's like the baby boomers do not have every answer. And maybe, in fact, they're part of the problem, like thinking that they have all the answers. So maybe we need to go back and, you know, is Pope Francis is a baby boomer, you know?
I didn't realize you were an angry young man.
No, it's just to say, like,
that was great stuff.
Yeah,
there is more to be. We do not have to always live in the same set of narrow questions that have been.
No, it's absolutely. And to his point, real quick, an anecdote. When I was at Notre Dame studying, I studied with Father Richard McCormick, S.J. Father McCormick, a wonderful man, but also on the other side of everything, right? He's one of the people against whom Veritatis Splendor was written. And he used, like, so... It's completely true. And of course, his response to it, by the way, is, you know, Veritatis Splendor gets us all wrong. We don't say what it says. We're not being condemned. But he was the greatest generation, right? And I was in the class. Chris Kazor, if you know who Chris Kazor is, was also in the class. So there are a couple of, like, you know, I guess were spies or something in his class. And, you know, he used to disagree with him all the time. And he'd sort of sit back, and it was in his house over cookies and coffee. And he'd say, well, you're just too young. When you grow up, you'll see, you know, that we're actually right. We've solved all these issues. You guys are just too young. It's an life experience issue, right? It's so dismissive, right, of argument of, wait, these questions are still open, right? No, they're not. Confirming.
Anyway, sorry, that was kind of taking us down a rabbit hole.
So back to more of the legal discussion. I do think one of the things that's been surfing around issues is that there really is no univocal definition of religion, and that, at least in the contemporary legal context, and that's part of what Vasilita highlighted yesterday, right? I kept thinking of which part of the Everlasting Man it is, when Chesterton has this wonderful send-up of the comparative study of a religions movement in the Western Academy, and he says it's, you take a category that is basically invented for the, basically describes the church, which has a recognizable body of law, and sort of works for Islam, and then for everything else, it's really just by analogy, and it gets a more and more attenuated analogy to the point where it's totally coherent. And I think that's sort of where we are with the category of religion in American law, where, I mean, in a case like, you know, in the contraceptive mandate cases, I mean, someone like Justice Alito, who actually understands the church's teaching, can see there are ways to establish degrees of responsibility and material versus formal cooperation with evil. There's a whole vocabulary for that kind of thing to hold people accountable. But when it's a prisoner saying he needs to grow his beard to a certain length so he can hide something in it, that might just be an arbitrary contingent matter, which he's claiming as an essential right of conscience. So it seems crucial to think this one through, and this is probably one of the deep areas where liberalism, thinking of it in terms of individuals, not in terms of communities, has a hard time. But the issue of justice under law is partly that non-discrimination law has been described so broadly. I mean, what we're dealing with is a legal regime developed in the 60s for the Civil Rights Acts, which is now being applied to all sorts of private transactions. And it is very invasive, and it's not clear whether those things can be better dealt with by existing criminal law. Like, why is there a category of hate speech as opposed to a category of, why is there an additional category of discrimination as opposed to the actual criminal statutes, which already exist and are much clearer? And then lastly, just on strategy, I mean, I think he said pretty clearly, indirectly, that he wants something like an insurgent grassroots citizen movement modeled after the NAACP strategy to take these things through the courts and not fight rearguard actions, but actually develop a body of legal doctrine to handle these things, not merely as reactive, defensive movements, which is what we've been doing. Partly, I think, because we have been too nice and too willing to lie down, and because we have vocabulary martyrdom, so we assume that's what the world recognizes, but the world doesn't understand that at the moment. So it's not at all clear that more lying down and more being nice is going to help.
It's just like a quick thing, but we're already moved on. I'll say it quickly then. I'll keep it brief. But it's just, it's a recommendation. Maybe this is going to the brainstorming session. Maybe you should invite for one session Professor Mark Rienzi from CUA Law School, who works at Beckett. And I took a class with him on religious liberty. I thought this was kind of illuminating from a legal perspective. We're not actually fighting the current narrative that we understand, where it's, okay, there is a religious good, and then there is a secular governmental goal, we'll call it like a government good, and they're in conflict, and only one can prevail. We have this narrative that these are all the cases. None of the big cases have been that. Because the government says, we would like, our goal is to get young women contraception. And then you have the Little Sisters of the Poor who say, well, we have other goals, but we would not like to provide contraception. And we're told that no, it's necessary that the Little Sisters do this, but it's not, because the government, our government, I'm not American, this government has from the beginning, from its constitution, recognized the important good of religion, and it's made a space for that, which it didn't need to, but it has. And so when the government steps back, it can clearly get people contraception without forcing nuns to be part of that. It's completely ridiculous. And they can say, yeah, is it going to be more complicated because they say that they can't for religious reasons? Is it more complicated to do it through some other means where they're not involved? It is. But that's the kind of whole concept and the precedent set in the United States, is that, yeah, it's worth making that kind of exception because we want to protect both goods. If we can have both goods, we will. So most of the cases are simply, and that's how you see it's kind of, we're on the defense, is because it is an attack. And one of the kind of elements that shows you that it's an attack going on the Little Sisters of the Poor is that the whole argument from the trial court all through the appellate courts that the government was making was these nuns don't understand that they aren't providing, the contraceptions. They're simply paying for the insurance policy, which they always had to do, and it's the insurance providing them the contraception. And these nuns just don't get that. They argued all, that was their argument, all the way up until the Supreme Court, where they knew that the court wouldn't buy that, because in the Supreme Court, you know, these elements of philosophy will come in. We're like, no, actually, you are in some way providing for the contraception. There's a direct line from them receiving it and you having to do something, which is logical. And they changed their tactic so that they could win at the Supreme Court. So it's just kind of to illuminate that, in that this is insight from Professor Ranzi that, you know, one, it is an attack, and two, so far we're not actually in that really hard area of, well, one has to win out. We're actually in an area where, no, actually we can have both, and that's been the precedent in our country, and we need to kind of respect that.
I can't, I have to jump in. Desmond, I deeply disagree with that for the following reason. I think it misdescribes the fundamental impulse behind these cases from the side of the state. I don't think the impulse in these cases is some neutral attempt to provide something that the state believes is a good. I think the impulse is to ensure that no one can refuse to provide these goods for a certain sort of reason. That is, there's an attempt to create a public political regime in which certain sorts of reasons are deemed inadmissible for action, either in the marketplace or in the forum of political life. And the reason, and this explains why the government's behavior is apparently irrational. So many people said, well, why is the government going after the Little Sisters? There are an infinite number of ways they could get contraceptives to, you know, whoever wants them. It's completely unnecessary to persecute this religious order. But of course, on the purposes of as I've described them, that attempt to establish that the religious order's reasons for its behavior were inadmissible was part of the goal, and indeed essential to the goal. So I deeply disagree with that, and I think you have to see that we're dealing with a regime that is centered around a set of ultimately theological principles, and wants to impose them. And that's the kind of beginning of wisdom of all these cases.
Yeah, I want to move us on, but I will add one word of affirmation of Adrian. There's an old friend of mine from many years ago involved in Planned Parenthood. Of course, we deeply disagree about a tremendous number of things, but so Planned Parenthood has put out, this is now almost maybe 15 or 18 years ago, the kind of legal strategy, like this is our long-term legal strategy, their kind of working paper, which they had a whole bunch of lawyers work out, somewhat like the strategy for how are we going to, you know, what, say, the NAACP did about how are we going to outlaw discrimination. But their goal was, how do we get Catholicism out of all healthcare, because they see it as the biggest obstacle to sort of more universal provision of abortion. And this is one of the pressure points that they saw that they could morally compromise Catholic hospitals, and that is their goal. So it isn't providing contraception. They actually don't. This is just, and I think the people in the Obama administration who were in charge of writing these rules were on that team.
Okay.
Our discussion will be captured by this if we do not say. So I'm just going to exercise arbitrary authority and say we're not going to discuss this anymore. Other, because there's tons of other questions that came up in our week together.
So this is a question about St. Thomas, so I don't probably be able to answer. This arose when we started talking about the plague of Carneades in Professor Daniel's class. It's sort of been percolating ever since.
I didn't hear you, Teresa, about talking about what?
The plague of Carneades.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I'm wondering, I think a large sort of dissatisfaction or a question behind the Enlightenment project was sort of a realization that it was sort of a questioning of St. Thomas's sort of thesis that, you know, man is most naturally happy in community, because I think they saw a community or society that was externally ordered toward God, but in which most men were deeply unhappy and not living well. And so perhaps that is why they sort of turned to this more like utopian individualist state of nature, where man does not live. So I guess I'm wondering, and I think perhaps even we can draw this analogy closer to home, which is that every man has been born into a family, and sure you could say, you know, he's most, his nature is most fully fulfilled, he's most happy within that natural community, but we also know examples where that community can be very disordered and can actually cause a great amount of unhappiness in his own life. So I guess my question is whether or not St. Thomas would say that community is an intrinsic good, like what every relation, insofar as it mirrors man's natural end, which is the beatific vision, which is relation with God. Everyone has the amount of days, so every relation with another person in a community is an intrinsic good, or do we need to qualify that to be one in which he is actually happy?
So I'm not sure I entirely understand your question. Do we need to qualify the good to live in society as not necessarily intrinsic to human being? Is it just a temporary good that drops away in heaven? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, I guess I'm wondering if every relation, every communal society is good because it mirrors, it participates in that, or does it need to be qualified so that man is actually living in direction toward God? I mean, I think you could say there are communities that are actually, that can actually disorder the soul or can actually lead someone away from God.
Yeah, I think that there are communities that can lead someone away. The kind of typical move that Aquinas is always going to make is say, well, something is good in a certain respect, but it's not good simply. So what is good simply? It has to be ordered all the way. Like, you have to have, all the parts have to be there. Like, all the dimensions have to be rightly ordered. And that's why you can go wrong in many different ways. So, there may be real goods in a human community that's not ordered under God, and we would still want to say these are partial goods. What the goods that they have are, we're not saying they're bad. They're just not fully good because they haven't been all ordered all the way. But he does, I think that the human creature is made for communion with others, and therefore it is never just an atomistic individual. So even salvation is in the body of Christ, and it's communion with the three persons of the Trinity, which doesn't destroy our sort of horizontal communion with each other. Rather, our horizontal communion is in a way strengthened and constituted more profoundly insofar as we are united to our head, and that is going to be the way that we flourish in the most ultimate sense. I mean, the communio school or the personalists will answer this question in a slightly different way, but I think the answer ends up being somewhat similar. They'll say, well, a person is someone who is made for communion, made for relation with another. And so if you don't have that relation with another, you're always going to be frustrated. Now, I think that as a way of kind of grounding the human essence or the human understanding, human nature, that doesn't tell you enough, but it is nonetheless true. So it does tell you something. I would want to give a deeper grounding, but I think that's true.
This is also a question for you, Father Legg. So when we were discussing the eternal law, it seemed like we could draw a connection between the eternal law and the Word, the divine Word. Does Aquinas do that? And I'm just wondering if you could talk about the status of the divine word in terms of God's creation of the world.
Yeah, so when he's talking about the divine word, then we're talking about a divine person, and you're going to need to articulate how when he speaks about the eternal law, he's really talking about God's creative plan, which isn't just the same as his eternal speaking of the word. So the eternal speaking of the word is going to, in a certain sense, contain already that divine plan. But he wouldn't say that the word is the same in, I mean, it is really the same. There's not a real distinction between God's plan for what he's going to do in creation and the word, in the sense that, like, this is all one in God. But what God's own providential plan is not simply his speaking of his divine essence, which is in a way what we're talking about when the Father speaks the word. He speaks himself. So it's less than. So Aquinas would say that the word contains every creature, every plan for every creature. In a way, it contains the plan for the whole of creation. So he is the eternal exemplar of all of that. So in a way, you could say, well, the eternal law is already in the word, or the word is the eternal law. But he doesn't mean by that, when he says eternal law, that he's talking about the procession of the word.
Okay.
Is that, I mean, I feel like I'm not maybe being as clear as I could be, but he wouldn't immediately go to saying this is just I'm talking about the Trinitarian procession here. That's a particular subject.
Right. Yeah.
Where we're trying to discuss distinction in God, in the one, you know, in the one God.
I've been doing a lot of thinking this week about the relationship of custom and tradition and culture to law, and discussed that a little bit in Aquinas, and following on that, so I kind of have two questions. One more specifically on Augustine, and whether or not he's advocating for, you know, like expansion of the heavenly city within the earthly city just by means of law, or by something greater, like culture or like custom. And that leads me to think about one of my favorite philosophers, this Italian guy named Augusto Del Noce. Everyone should read, and he makes an argument for the expansion of progressivism, that it was really a combination of the spiritual principles of Freudian psychology, led by a guy named William Reich, and spiritual principles of Marxism that really infiltrated the bourgeois liberalism of America and allowed these spiritual principles of pleasure and pain to take over in such a way that he's you know, talking about this happening back in the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s, and then that became sexual liberation, and then all of that starts getting translated into law. So part of his argument is that a lot of this happens before it actually shows up in the polity. And so I guess my question is, the first one on Augustine, and then, add to the bit of Augusto Del Noce, he argues that a lot of this was led by surrealist artists. And he quotes André Breton very, very powerfully, arguing that through their reconception of reality, they can break apart, they will free the woman sexually, they will break apart the Christian family, they will break apart the nuclear family and basically bring down Christianity. And it's really, really powerful. And so my question is, Augustine, and whether or not we look to expand the heavenly city within the earthly city through law or through custom or through both, and more generally, what is the place of art in the kinds of in the strategy that we're building to try to win people back to the spiritual principles that once united us.
Yeah, on the first question, just by expansion, what do we mean? Increase the numbers of its members?
Right.
Or something more?
Preserve the heavenly city within the earthly city and bring pilgrims in.
I mean, the shortest answer to say is, in a way, I don't know. I don't know how he answers that, if he answers that. As you know, right, there's a strong providential component to what he says, and even predestination, you know, predestinary component to what how he's operating. So in terms of increasing its numbers, I don't know if he thinks we really do that, right, in any way, like that what we do will affect the numbers, right, as Christians. So I mean, there's probably more to say there. If you want to follow up on it, feel free to, but I don't think he's thinking that way. I think he's instead thinking of how its members sort of make their way in this world. The sort of evangelical, let's say, aspect of this, there's not that kind of strategy, let's put it that way, that I'm aware of in him. I'll let these guys take a whack at art first if they want to, but that's a great question. I know a little bit of Del Noce's work. I mean, this is important stuff, right? I guess I'm not going to let them go first. Clearly, whatever we're doing can't just happen in terms of argument, writing, apology, etc., right? That's proving inefficient, or ineffective, I guess. If that's going to be the only mode we rely on, at some point there's going to have to be some reclaiming of ground around beauty, right? And the way that human beings respond to beauty. I think we've sort of ceded a lot of ground on that. Also, in part, it's been liturgical, right? It's been architectural in the church, right? Among us, right? The choices that we make, we're responsible, right? I don't want to shove responsibility to church architects and bishops and people like that. We're responsible for this as much as anybody else in not prioritizing beauty as a good, right? And arguing about what can be beautiful, right? I mean, every time you have a conversation with anybody these days, it all begins with, this is just subjective, right? It's just preference. And to concede that, of course, is to just evacuate any attempt to do what you're describing.
Yeah, I mean, I'd agree on this. And beauty has an intelligibility, and it can be argued about, and there's a kind of a truth content to it, too. I mean, Aquinas thinks that these are transcendentals, that you can go from being to truth to beauty and to goodness. These are different ways of speaking in a certain way about the same reality. So it would make perfect sense that if you wanted to undermine one kind of holistic conception, that if you disrupt with respect to beauty and capture the imagination that way, that you would do a lot of damage. I'm not sure that you can just make something beautiful and therefore say we've done enough.
Oh, sure, of course.
I know that you would agree with that. So sometimes that's
not a bad start, though.
Yeah, I mean, Father Thomas Joseph just gave a talk where on beauty, can beauty save the world? And his conclusion is basically, the beauty of a true argument can save the world.
That's awesome.
Great. Well, we are unfortunately out of time, so the saving of the world will have to come after this conference. But at least we have the resources now. Many beautiful arguments have been put forward, and so hopefully we all feel suitably empowered to carry on the work of the conference and saving the world from here on out.